Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com worldwide on the internet. This week, we visit with another Valley veteran of World War II who spent his time in the China-Burma-India Theater, although that's not where he initially thought he was going. There's going to be some interesting stories to be told over the next hour as we welcome Chowchilla rancher John Wolfshorndle to the program. John, I say you're a rancher because you are still running the show on your acres of almonds, is that right?
Yes, that's true. We're in the middle of harvest right now.
How long have you been doing that? Was that a family farm?
Oh, yeah, it's a family farm. I've been doing it all my life. As soon as I got out of the service, went right back to farming again. Of course, there's a lot of difference between what we farmed then and how we do it now.
So 83 years young, and you're still going?
Still going.
Because the almonds are just as good as they were 60 years ago, right?
Yes, they're delicious.
Speaking of 60 years ago, take me back. I like to ask every guest that we have on the program how he or she first heard about December 7th, 1941, and what happened at Pearl Harbor. What do you remember about that Sunday morning?
Well, I think we just come home from church. It was a Sunday morning, and us standing on the steps of the house, and somebody drove up and says, Pearl Harbor's been bombed. And I says, Pearl Harbor?
And you're in Chowchilla.
Yes,
right?
Chowchilla. Uh-huh. I says, where's Pearl Harbor? Well, come to find out, that was really something. So Monday morning, I was a junior in high school, and the PA system come on, and we had a live broadcast of President Roosevelt declaring a state of war against the Empire of Japan, proposing to Congress. You know, of course, they have to do the declaring.
What did that mean to you at the time? You're probably just thinking, hey, football season's over. Yeah. That's a bummer.
Well, just an 18-year-old kid. Well, I was a 17-year-old then, and... Yeah. Hey, it turned the whole picture upside down because this was no fooling around. I mean, this was serious business, and the handwriting was kind of on the wall, especially when you get into senior class and on. Some kids were graduating in their midterm in a senior year, so they could go into the branch of the service that they wanted to enlist in, as with Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, or whatever.
They didn't want to wait to get drafted. They wanted to make their choice.
I was needed on the farm, and so I stayed till I graduated, and then sure enough, here comes the greetings card. And
is that what you called it?
Yeah, from Uncle Sam. So that's how it all started.
So Uncle Sam said, you're an Army guy, Army Air Corps. How'd you end up getting those wings?
Well, I went to Sacramento for a physical for the last time, and it just happened to be there was a Navy man, a officer there, and he was taking his pick out of the guys as we walked past them. I guess mm-hmm. We're stripped down to our waist, and he just had one look at each one and says, if he didn't like you, he'd just pass you by, and if he wanted somebody, he said, I want you. And you were going into the Navy. Well, he walked right by me, and I says, whoa, good deal. I didn't want to be nothing to do with boats, you know. So, but I was assigned.
You mean you didn't spend enough time in the Brenda Slough out there?
No, well, too much bamboo out there. that's how it wound up. I wound up in the Air Force, and I was drafted, and we went to Kearns, Utah for basic training at south of Salt Lake City there.
What was tougher, working on the farm or basic training?
Well, basic training, I mean, you know, when you're in basic, they really grill you, and you go through things that you never thought you'd ever be doing before, testing physical strength and agility and things like that. So, which I did good at, and since I was in that mode, I said, boy, you know, I wouldn't mind being an airplane mechanic, you know. I says, hey, this is just the right route to go, you know. But as it turned out a little bit different than that.
Yeah, how did that happen? How did you end up as an aerial gunner?
Well, we finished basic training, and I was assigned to air crew. So I went through armament training in Denver, Colorado. That was Lowry Field, and gunnery training in Laredo, Texas, where we had flexible and stationary and ground fire training, aerial, all kind of gunnery training. And there we went to Peterson Field, Colorado, and then that's when we came together as a crew, a crew of 10. Mm-hmm. And we were flying out of Peterson Field. It was in the winter time, but we were losing bombers out there from the weather, and so they transferred us to Mountain Home, Idaho. And so as a crew, we finished training as a bomber outfit, ready to go. But then something happened.
Well, yeah, I want to hear about that. But first, let's talk a little more about what this takes to be a gunner. I imagine the first time they put you in the air, and they probably said, shoot that sleeve that the other plane's dragging or something like that. I imagine you didn't hit every single shot the very first time.
Well, the first time I took off in a plane, I was flying backwards. In an AT-6, there's a pilot in front of me. I had a 30 caliber machine gun, and it was on a half moon slide. You had to slide it into the slipstream, and we were down on ground level and shooting at targets down there. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first airplane ride. And hey, I'd done pretty good on that, but it was later on in gunnery. There was two of us tied for first place out of 400 guys. So that was quite an honor for me. I didn't even know I was in a contest. We were in a contest, but it was a lot of fun, but it was serious business too.
Sounds like you had pretty good aim.
Well, you kind of get settled in. You know, you can't get. You can't blink before you shoot, you know.
Now, at one time or another, you had to occupy different positions in the plane, because I imagine you talked about flying backwards the first time you ever flew on an AT-6.
Yes.
You ended up as a nose gunner on a B-24. You're flying forwards that way.
That's
in fact, that's the best seat on the plane if
yes.
you're talking about seeing
yeah.
things.
Yeah, right.
How big of a difference was it being the nose gunner as opposed to, say, a tail gunner?
Well, I was only in the tail position one time, and that was we'll get to this later. This is about the aircraft business, one time we saw unidentified fighters off to our left, and I alerted the crew. You know, you have intercom. You know, everybody's connected with intercom,
right.
Where there were throat mics actually, and they're quite effective, and we all had we had 8 50 calibers,
mm-hmm.
Two in each turret, and there were 4 turrets, upper and a lower and a nose and a tail, and they kind of hung around out there, but they didn't come after us, so we were thankful for that.
But did you prefer being in the nose?
Yes, I had my choice there, but I wouldn't want to fly in that ball turret. If you were claustrophobic, I mean, that thing was very confining. And But on the other hand, if you ever had a bailout, it was the easiest one to bail out of, because you were wearing a back chute. There were 3 kinds of chutes. Pilots had seat packs, and the rest of us guys had chest packs. We always wore a harness, and our chute pack would be real close. And in case of a bailout, you just snap it on, and out you go. Well, that back pack on that belly gunner, he's laying down all cramped up with his knees up close, and with if he had to bail out, all he had to do is flick a couple levers right above him, and he just falls right out into the slipstreams very, very conveniently.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, you had to be hydraulically jacked back up into the fuselage of this B-24. Like, this is the same Sperry turret that the B-17s had,
right.
But theirs were stationary in the 24s because of tricycle landing gear. You had to elevate it up.
Well, just hearing you talk about that reminds me of a story that we heard on this program from a B-24 pilot here in Fresno who had his ball turret gunner stuck in there because the hydraulics got shot up, and he had to land the plane without killing the guy in that bottom turret, and he pulled it off. But you've heard that story already here on Hometown Heroes in a previous week from Charlie Brown, an old B-24 pilot. So we continue here with John Wolfshorndel, and I want to just get back to your outlook at this point. When you're in training, your crew, everything you know, you're heading to Europe. And I'm sure you're hearing reports about what's happening there and how the bombers are getting hit pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Well, you go ahead and tell you how we wound up from going.
Yeah, well, answer me this. Were you... You had a feeling you were going to Europe, right?
Yes, the orders were cut, and
uh-huh.
we were just waiting for the get on board and take off. We'd get on our own plane and head out. And
did that make you nervous at all? Were you thinking about, I'm going to, and you'd seen the reports about places like Ploesti and all these spots where they'd been really ripped to shreds?
Yeah, got hammered pretty bad there.
So was that a little unnerving to think, I'm going right into the thick of that?
You don't know what you're getting into. You're just unified as a crew. We depend on each other. Everybody's got his job to do, and there's the best bunch of guys that you ever can have, you know. I mean, when you're in a position where it's a life and death situation, which you could be into, and you want to be sure the other guy's doing his job, and I have to be responsible for the job that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of trust involved in those kind of situations. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to hear how things changed for you. We're going to leave the listeners planning on you heading off to Europe and flying in B-24s all over the skies over the European theater, and then we'll find out about that twist of fate that sent them to the other side of the world. John Wolfshorndel, our guest today on Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
A very appropriate choice this week as we visit with U.S. Army Air Corps veteran John Wolfshorndel, who was a nose gunner on a B-24 crew in the China-Burma-India theater. This wasn't a normal B-24, and we're going to find out about that. And in fact, when we left you off before the commercial, we had John and his crew headed to Europe to join a outfit of bombers there, and there was a little twist of fate, and you never knew it at the time how thankful you were going to be to this buddy of yours. But let's hear the story. How did you end up getting out of that trip to Europe?
Well, the way it turned out, we were waiting to go. And so one evening, just before this decision was made to leave, our tail gunner, a guy by the name of John T. Swick from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, he was going to go down to a bar in off base, the downtown, and have a drink and enjoy himself down there. And so meanwhile, there was a curfew. I think it was 11 p.m. And of course, we were
which you never broke personally, right?
No, I never did. But you had to be back on base, and you had to be in uniform. Well, he was having such a great time down there in that bar. He asked the bartender, says, "Hey, you know where I can get a whole set of civvy clothes? I got to get out of this GI uniform, or I'm going to have the MPs on me, you know, because that's a violation of being off base and no uniform." Yeah, okay. So he got the civvy clothes for him, and so this was without the rest of the crew knowing what was going on. We were all in bed, I believe, back at the base.
Well, you better have been. It was after curfew.
That's right. And so he got the Raising Cane down there, and somebody tipped off the MPs, which is military police, and they come down there, and they caught him down there without being in uniform and after hours. And so they threw him in the jug. You know what that is.
Yeah. You're not talking about a P-47.
No.
A different kind of jug.
You were behind bars.
Yeah.
Well, nobody knew about this. Next morning, my pilot gets notified that John T. Swick is in the brig. And so he got to wait for a court-martial. That was a court-martial offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think it was really that serious, but, I mean, it was in those days, you know. So, that's my pilot, Mike Howes, from Florida. He says, we got to do something. I don't want to break up my crew. We've been training together for over a year, and why break up a crew, you know, which would very well could have happened, you know. They'd have shipped out without us, and they'd have give us assigned another a tail gunner to our crew, which has been, nobody knew, really.
Right.
And
And you needed to have that teamwork and camaraderie to be as successful
and
as you
could. And so he got the pilot to check with operations. He says, hey, is there any other outfits in the States here that could use a B-24 crew? And they got to do some checking. Yes, in Will Rogers Field, south of Oklahoma City, there's a photo plane operations. That's a B-24 that's converted to an F-7. F meaning photo, and the 7 was a designation. And so we got out of there. And meanwhile, Swick was released on his own recognizance to show up at this court-martial. So I says, whoa, I said, you got them all together now. So we all got on a B-24. Mm-hmm. Was operations knew about this. And we flew off to Oklahoma City, to Will Rogers Field with our crew intact. And so this is how we got into a photographic a mode B-24. Now that we would have otherwise wound up in southern Italy at a dirt gravel airstrip down there, and no telling where we'd have pulled missions off into Germany or whatever, you know. And it was pretty rough. In fact, one of those crews we left with he went down in the ocean. They never did find him anymore. Mm. And it was we heard of another one being shot down, so we were thankful that we weren't involved in that. So here we are now. We had another 6 weeks of training as a unit on aerial photography.
I think our listeners can read between the lines here, but I want to hear it from you. Do you think it's possible that his little escapade there actually saved your life?
Well, who knows? It's possible, you know. Anything's possible, you know. But I often think about that. Says, now, why did this happen? You know, here we are, another half a world away, you know, and because of this one incident of the tail gunner, and this whole picture turns around 180, mm-hmm. And so we went down to 36th Street Airport in Miami Beach, got on a C-54, a four-engine, because mm-hmm. you have to fly four engines going over the ocean. And we didn't know where we were going. And all we knew, we were headed east. And after we got airborne, it says, well, you guys are going to Karachi, India. I says, Karachi, who? I says, we never even heard of the place, you know, but it was in India, you know. And
yep.
So we had some stops along the way, Bermuda, Azores, and Casablanca, Abdan, Iran, Cairo, Egypt, and then Karachi, and
mm-hmm.
so from there we changed planes again, and went right on into Gushkara, India, which is about 70 miles north of Calcutta, and that was our home base, and that's what we operated out of.
And it was just like Chowchilla, wasn't it?
not hardly.
I imagine there was a bit of a culture shock and an eye-opener see what life was like there.
The real cultural shock was when you got over to India, and they had just got out of that caste system where they're what they call the untouchables.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a class of people that are so low, that's below dog and cats, mm-hmm. Politically speaking. And it was awful. And but anyway, that's... You're really, you got an eye opener when you go over there. That's really a third world country. It really was at that time.
And so now you're part of the 24th Combat Mapping Squadron.
Right.
Part of the 10th Air Force. And your duties are to what? You're flying up in the air and taking lots of pictures and hope you don't get shot down?
That's true.
A little simplification of it.
Yes, we actually flew most missions at 20,000 feet above terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Me, terrain being whatever ground level you were flying over, you had to be 20,000 feet above. So this was really a navigator's nightmare, because we had to fly flight lines back and forth in a designated area where we thought there was Japanese operations going on, and they had these big Fairchild cameras on board. There was a photo man on board.
Yeah, this B-24, this was had some pretty significant modifications here.
Oh, yes.
Where there's normally bombs.
Yes.
There aren't any bombs on your B-24.
No. Nope.
It's the B doesn't really stand for bomber
no,
in
no,
your
no,
case.
No, it's, That's why they went F7.
And so what was there instead of the bombs? You had some extra fuel tanks?
Yes. B-24 has two bomb bays. They're, right together. And so they took and placed big, whatever they could, fuel tanks, one on each half. And that gave us very long extended flight lines. So the longest I ever been on was one flight was 16 hours.
That's a pretty
round
good range.
Trip. And the back half was a photo room. And that was all set up for the photo man. He had big cameras here. We had cameras in the nose. And he would automatically take pictures with these cameras. It was film is 9 inches wide and 500-foot rolls for length. And so you could cover a lot of territory. So then when we'd come back, we'd go to we had a photo lab on the base. Mm-hmm. And they immediately went out with the Jeep and unloaded those cameras and went straight to the photo lab with them. And they, what they call souping them out. And then they laid them out, a mosaic, on this huge floor and of what pictures were taken. And they picked out what was likely to be of interest to the Air Force and fighter squadrons. That was turned over to the authorities in those groups, and they went back and done a number on these guys.
So how far were you guys flying? How deep were you going? I mean, we're going into China. Where are we going here?
Okay, in China we had an advanced base. We had two of them. The Japanese run us out of one of them, but there was still one left in the Chanyi. In the Yunnan province, it's right on the Burma Road, and that's where I was only in China for 1 month. Mm-hmm. That's where we greeted New Year's with a bombing raid on the airstrip right at midnight, and killing a captain and his weapons carrier. And we saw the thing the next morning, that's
what happens when you hear. You guys have an air raid siren there that alerts you?
Oh, yes. We bailed out, and it was a bright, moonlit night.
So you're asleep, and that wakes you up?
The what?
Were you asleep, and that woke you up?
I think it was. It was midnight. We were in the barracks, and the siren went off, and we knew this was a slit trench out in the back of the barracks of what was used to be a Chinese cemetery.
Mm.
So there had been digging up dead Chinese and had bones and... Mm. Things there.
You dug the slit trench and found a lot more than dirt.
Yes.
Right. So you go hide. You go try to get in there.
Oh yeah, we got in there and till the all clear. With the siren, you have one. You have a different type of tone for the oncoming air raid, and then for the all clear, you have a long drawn out deal, and it was over with. And so.
What goes through your mind in a situation like that? It seems kind of helpless to me.
Ask yourself, what am I doing here and the rest of us guys? But that was a job to do. And so, but we pulled missions over French Indochina and Burma, as it's called Myanmar now, and portions of India, too, that we made pulled missions on.
Well, we're going to talk about some of those missions when we come back, including the one that he still has a souvenir from in his scrapbook, a souvenir that could have taken his life or someone else on that plane's life. John Wolfshorndle of Chowchilla, our guest today. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
String of Pearls, the late, great Glenn Miller there, a popular choice of many of the veterans that we welcome onto this program today. John Wolfshorndle of Chowchilla is our guest. He is still farming all of his acres of almonds, and he still has a lot of memories from the war. He's preserved a lot of those in some really impressive plywood-lined scrapbooks here. I'm looking at one of them right now, and it includes a letter, John, that you sent home. And I wanted to read a little bit of this just to give the folks at home, and many of them are of your generation, so they understand this completely. But the reality that faced you, here you are, a teenager, 18 years old, at basic training in Utah, and you're writing your father a letter that says, I've enclosed a $10,000 life insurance, which practically every soldier has, in case anything should happen to me. Then you put in parentheses, in case of death, you will get this money from the government. And you go on to talk more about it and talk about what the Red Cross will do. And this was a real thing for you. I mean, you had to sit there and contemplate, I might not live to see 19 or 20. That seems like a lot to swallow as a young man. And when you look back, and obviously your family saved this letter, you have it here in your scrapbook. When you look back at your handwriting and read that, does it bring back those memories? Does it take you back to that moment?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's got a lot more in this scrapbook that we're going to talk about. A couple scrapbooks, in fact. We left off. You're in the China-Burma-India Theater. You told us some of the locations that your plane was flying over, and the one that you primarily flew in as the nose gunner was called the Flying Anvil, which is a very apt description of what a B-24 looks like, huh? That big flat nose.
The thing was, if you lost two or more engines, you flew like an anvil. you bought the ranch.
You're not talking about your almond ranch or chinchilla. No, yeah, I know the expression. And if that happened, you're sitting right in the nose of that thing, so you're going to be the first one in.
It takes...
What would it take for you to bail out of that?
Out of that nose turret, see, we had a double door there. You had, because it swiveled, mm-hmm. and so you had the door for the turret, and then you also had an entrance door right back to back that was right in next to the navigator's apartment or the bombardier in either case, and he had to open that door before I could open my door, and so, and the chute, the parachute was right there in that compartment out there because you could not wear it in a turret because it was too
cramped.
It's too cramped and getting your way and it just wouldn't work. So you ought to get out of that turret, snap on that. It was very very easy, fast snap on. It just as a chest pack, and it was ready to go. You got your red handle there, a rip cord, and you bail out right out through the nose.
So you had to be prepared to do that on every time you took to the skies.
Yeah.
And we talked about how this was a photo reconnaissance plane, an F-7, loaded with cameras as part of the 24th Combat Mapping Squadron in the 10th Air Force. And most of the time you're in the nose of this plane.
Yes.
But there's one mission. They stick you in the tail.
Yeah, I don't know why. I didn't really mind it. That was the only time I ever rode that tail.
Well, I wouldn't write it after what happened to you.
No.
Keep going, yeah.
Okay. Can we go ahead?
Yeah, let's hear the story.
Oh, all right. Well, we were assigned to take photos of the Lasho Burma Railroad Junction. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese had that completely occupied there, and we had to go check and see on what they had on the rail yards in there. And of course, it was ringed with anti-aircraft guns. And so we went over taking pictures, and all of a sudden, I was in the tail. Of course, I was riding backwards, and I heard all these loud explosions, and I thought we were losing some engines or something. And then all of a sudden, I hear all these black puffs of smoke come by, and whoa, that's
you knew what that was.
That is not engines. And so Mike, the pilot, he was doing some violent, evasive maneuvers, and trying to get out of there as fast as we could, and which we did. But in the process, we did get hit twice. One was in the ball turret. It was a piece went right to the side and slammed into the. There's a big trunnion bearing there. It's all cast aluminum. You know what the turret turns on, and it hit that, and then glanced back down inside of the plane right, which is on the bottom of the plane there. Very close. So, and the other one slammed into my Mike House's pilot seat cushion. So that's how close he come to getting these Well, whatever shot off, you know. And
so, they had some pretty good reinforcement on the seat, I guess. Yeah.
And we talked about that at our last reunion here in this last April. But, we got home all in one piece. But we weren't the only ones that got shut up on that particular place, you know, because they were very sensitive about that. And, you know, I mean, hey.
Well, obviously, that's why you guys had to take pictures of it, because there's something going on down there.
That's right.
And you ended up with a piece of that shrapnel that you brought home.
Yes, I reached down, and after we got into home territory, we were down on low elevation. We were off oxygen, and I got to looking around. I saw a hole in the side of the plane. I says, whoa. I says, what? Something's hit here. And I saw this piece of shrapnel laying right on the bottom of the belly of the plane, and I reached down to pick it up, and I got a violent shock off of it. Must have been static electricity, so I dropped it, I thought it's too hot yet, you know. It must have been cool by now. So I'm going to try picking it up again, and which I did, and it was okay then.
It didn't shock you that time.
And Mike, he had his piece, and he saved it, and I think he lost it. He didn't know where it's at.
But you held on to yours, and now it's sitting in your
scrapbook. Yeah, it was a little larger than what I had here. There was a piece that was almost broke off, and the second engineer wanted to... a piece of it, so I broke off a piece and gave him, and I kept the rest of it, kept the large piece.
And that's, I'd say the piece you have in there is probably a good 3 inches long.
Oh, yeah.
When you look at it, does it bear any significance for you? Does it remind you how close you guys came to getting it?
You know, I mean, you hear these things going on all the time, you know, and especially over in Europe, you know, they really got slammed hard over there, especially that Ploesti raid. Mm-hmm. And, hey, he says, hey, you just do your job, what you got to do, and everybody's doing what they have to do, and just get out of there. We're going to, he said, they're shooting at us. We're not going to take any more pictures, because, we were kind of sitting ducks up there.
Well, but what one thing that you said struck me, because I've talked to a lot of bomber pilots, and they talk about how you had to fly in formation. When they're in a bomb squadron and they have formation...
That's true.
The flak's coming at them. They can't dodge it because they
that's
have
right.
to maintain formation.
That's
you
right.
guys had an advantage. Every mission was just your plane? Flew alone?
We flew solo all the time. We never did fly in formation because we just had a designated area to map, and we went out there, and we had no fighter escort, and that's the way we did it.
So that gave your pilot a chance to maneuver around a little bit.
Yes.
Not that a B-24 moves like
a gazelle. It really maneuvered. I'll clue you for sure.
His shoulders were probably sore for a week after that. Huh? Any other close calls that you recall or moments that maybe kind of made you think, yikes, that could have been it?
Well, not really in an airplane. I almost got accidentally was killed by friendly fire in Karachi, India. We were waiting for the plane to take us on into Gushkara, and we were out there all lined up on a bench here next to a wall, and we had just been issued brand new pistols, and when we left Florida with a full clip of ammunition, and the belly gunner from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, John Doyle was his name, and he decided he was aiming at a wall, a barracks right across from us there, and I was walking along, and here these guys were all lined up, and I was just walking by, and so he had pulled the slide back on that pistol and let it fly forward, and I got just right up to him, and something told me, I believe in guardian angels for sure. I stopped just in this nick of time, and that .45 went off, and it didn't actually hit me. It must have been maybe 2-3 inches from me, and something told me to stop right there, and I backed up, and bang, that thing went off, and whoa. Of course, now you talk about somebody with pie on his face. He wasn't even thinking. You know, he thought he was dry firing that thing, and he just pulled the slide back on. Of course, a bullet went right into the chamber. So, I never did hold it against him. It was
you were thankful to be alive.
We all got along real fine.
I'm sure he was thankful you were alive, too. Holy moly. Well, we need to catch our final commercial break here. Then we'll come down the home stretch with John Wolfshorndl, talk about where he was when the war ended, what he remembers about that, maybe some of the things he's been up to since, and share some of his thoughts about what we ought to remember about World War II and the men and women who bravely served our country during that period. You're listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
He was a famous trumpet man from old Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowin' reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam.
You remember the Andrews Sisters? Probably been a while since you heard that one. Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. Today it's a nose gunner boy, a Chowchilla boy with us. John Wolfshorndl grew up in Chowchilla, went off to serve our country in World War II. The twist of fate he described earlier kept him from heading to Europe. Instead, he went to the China, Burma, India Theater. You heard about his close call in that souped-up B-24 that was part of the 24th Combat Mapping Squadron. And now we're going to hear more about his experiences during the war down the last 9 minutes or so of this program today. Let's talk about flying the hump, John. And for anyone that isn't familiar with that term, that means going over the tallest mountain range in the world, the Himalayas, which
That's right.
is not a picnic, was it?
No. Well, you have to realize, in those days, we had no pressurized cabins. Mm-hmm. Everything was just atmospheric. Cold would come in there on you. In fact, we wore electric suits, electric gloves, and electric shoes to keep from getting inoperative. You know, we just get stiff. And I had to crank those things up so high that it would kind of burn the back of my hands a little bit and behind my knees because they were all folded up to stay comfortable. But they worked fine. But the thing is, if you ever had to bail out with those electric shoes, you had a problem. We had to take our combat boots with us, and you went out together with those boots because you couldn't walk. It's just like walking in slippers or something.
Well, yeah, you didn't want to be bailing out while you're flying over the hump.
No.
It's not too easy to survive that one.
Yeah.
I imagine there's a lot of clouds that you're dealing with and stuff like that, but what was that like? Were you in the nose for that? Or were you in a
no,
C-47 or something like that?
No, we were in a B-24.
Yeah.
The aluminum trail. Now, what mm-hmm. is the aluminum trail? Well, all he had to do on a clear day, if you're flying from Jorhat to Kunming, China, you didn't need a navigator. All you had to do is follow the wreckage along the way.
So everything that was left of the battles that had been on the ground?
Well, mostly was operational. It was something going wrong or got in the storm and forced down or lost their way and slammed into mountains and it was just a trail of aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently called the aluminum trail.
And I can see the emotion in your eyes, what that means to you, to think of all the guys, your fellow Air Corps veterans who never came home.
Yeah.
And, the Fresno Bees had this series lately on the Sierra and all the wrecks there.
Oh, yes, I've been following that.
But the Himalayas, a little higher than that.
Yes,
30,000 feet is a little different than 15.
Somewhat.
Is that breathtaking, though, when you're up that high? I know you're just shivering and trying to stay warm and hoping that electric suit doesn't electrocute you or burn you, but was it something that was awe-inspiring to see the mountains and their majesty?
Oh, absolutely. It's that's the highest range in the world, and vicious wet weather in that, because you never know what you're going to get into. Of course, in the modern-day planes, they fly way up 40,000 feet above, you know, and whatever. You know, you don't even know anything's going on now in pressurized cabin, you know. And
mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, imagine when you fly now, it's like not even flying, huh?
No.
When you just flew to Germany?
Yeah.
A little different than flying a B-24.
No problem.
You guys didn't have stewardesses on the B-24s either.
Not hardly.
Other than the nose art
that
might have qualified in some cases. Where were you when you heard that this is all over, that Japan has surrendered and you get to go home?
Okay. The war had just ended, And we were at a home base in Gushkara in India, and somebody come and talked to some of the guys, and I was one of them from operations. We could use some guys in the Clark Field in the Philippines. The Philippines had never been photographed before, and so being a gunner, they didn't have any use for gunners anymore. We were out of commission right then and there. Our job was done. So he asked me, hey, you want to go to Philippines? I'll give you another stripe. I was a buck sergeant, and I'll give you another stripe, and you go and whatever. But I didn't know what I was going to do. I says, whoa, you mean to tell me for the first time in my life, and when I've been in this man's army, I got a choice about what I want to do? I said, goodbye, I'm going home. So that's what happened.
And I don't think anybody would blame you for that. So you came home to Chowchilla right away?
Oh, yes.
Got back on the farm?
Oh, yeah.
And you're still doing it?
Still doing it.
But you're going to hang it up this year?
Well, I'm thinking about it pretty hard. It's in the works now.
Uh-huh. Is that something that you're looking forward to? What are you going to do to stay busy?
I'll stay busy. If it isn't honeydew projects, it's out to chicken water for the boys or with the Yamaha. And there's always something to do there. Good. Plenty to do there. Just keep me busy.
Mm-hmm. Imagine you've seen the area around your acres change a little bit over the years.
Immensely. I can't believe what's going on out there with almonds.
Well, I'm glad that you're still working it and it's still treating you all right. And I'm sure that the people you do business with will miss you if you're not doing that business with them anymore. I mentioned your scrapbooks that you have brought in to share with us today, and so many great pictures, so many memories. You've been to a lot of reunions with your group. In fact,
yes,
like so many groups,
yes,
you guys just had your last reunion.
Yes, in April Kissimmee, Florida, which was our final reunion, and 12 guys showed up. And included in that was our radio operator that nobody had seen in 63 years. That's the first time he ever showed up. That was a surprise. That was really great.
Some good-natured ribbing.
Yeah, and there were four guys out of that crew of 10 that showed up. Five of them had already passed away, and the fifth one, he's the still alive. He's in Trafford, Pennsylvania, the first engineer. He's not physically able to attend anymore.
And your group, your reunion group, has a bottle of wine that's being saved for a special occasion?
Yes. I still got it. It's in the basement. It's labeled the last two men toast and salute. It says the last two guys left alive get to kill the bottle.
And you're keeping that at your house?
Well, I am right now. It's made the rounds. We shipped it around different guys, you know, and winds back to my place. I said, hey, I don't know who the last two guys are going to be. All I know, there's still four of us, five of us still around yet.
On the crew. So that's just for your crew, your 10-man crew.
Yes, just my crew.
Well, I'm counting on you being one of the last two. Not that it'll be a joyous occasion when it's down to two, but we look forward to hearing your story about that. Before we close out the program, I wanted you to read the last page from your scrapbook that you made. It's something that obviously you took great care in putting on paper because it was important to you to preserve some very strong feelings about World War II and what you guys did. Why don't you read that for us?
Okay, this is the title, In Retrospect. A salute to the Minutemen of 1776, to the blue and gray of the Civil War that redefined ourselves as a nation. The doughboys of World War I who fought and died in the muddy slit trenches of France and foreign soil. Then World War II, a final salute to those who paid the ultimate price and sacrifice for our flag and beloved nation. We did not burn our draft cards, run off to Canada when we were called upon to serve. Sent areas of battle halfway around the world, two fronts where happiness was the crew of a B-24 Liberator getting through an anti-aircraft barrage without having a foxhole to dive into. The victory was won, and now another generation must answer the call to defend our freedoms. Freedom is not free, never is, never was, and never will be. As we, the yet living, remember our fallen buddies, may our Heavenly Father, in his own good grace and time, allow us all to meet again.
I think there's a lot of amens out there among our listeners, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. I know it wasn't easy to get through reading all that. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for your service to our country and to our valley. Thanks for being here today, and enjoy your retirement when it comes. John Werfschoendel was our guest today here on Hometown Heroes. We'll be back with another edition of the program next week here on News Talk 580 KMJ.